Welcome to the Power of Attorney Project, which is part of our Conversations That Matter podcast. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. This podcast is intended to provide general information only and is not intended to be a substitute for seeking personalized legal, financial, or other advice. This podcast raises issues that our audience can further explore on their own in their own local communities with their own local experts. This project will help to be a call to action for families to solve their issues, find solutions to their problems, and have greater peace of mind.
And today's podcast is called Predatory Marriages with Seniors. And our guest expert is Stephen Benmore. Stephen is the principal lawyer with Benmore Family Law Group. Welcome, Stephen.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining our project. Before I go into my list of questions, could you please share a bit about your practice?
Absolutely. Thank you, Mary, for even inviting me. And I'm happy to share with you information about this very interesting and developing subject. But before I do, let me introduce myself. I am a family law lawyer, also called a divorce lawyer. And for the last 20 years, I have represented and advised husbands and wives, parents, and even grandparents on the subjects of custody and access to children, parenting plans for children, child support for children, and also spousal rights such as property division upon separation and divorce, also issues pertaining to domestic violence, and contracts that allow people to forward plan. So effectively, my area of practice is assisting people understand the rights and remedies stemming from marriage and resulting from separation and divorce.
Well, thank you for that. That's very interesting. And I'd like to begin with my first question for you. And it is, how are rights changed because of marriage?
So interestingly, family law lawyers who are experts on the subject of the legal consequences of marriage are rarely ever consulted on the subject of marriage, meaning we as lawyers usually only get involved when people are discussing separation and divorce. But quite frankly, the much larger issue is what happens to somebody's rights when they decide to get married. When they walk into City Hall and they get a marriage license, their legal rights are dramatically changed as a result of marriage. Specifically, marriage under Ontario law is recognized as an economic partnership. So no different than if somebody decided to go into partnership in purchasing a building or a business or starting a new business, marriage unto itself is considered an economic partnership under the law of Ontario. And as a result, when two people marry, they become financial partners, which basically means that any assets that either person has on the date of marriage, as those assets grow, the growth is automatically considered family growth, not individual growth. And so therefore, the assets that are accumulated or that grow during the course of a marriage, which could be as short as a few months or as long as a few decades, that growth is otherwise considered shared growth under the laws of Ontario. Secondly, marriage also creates support obligations. So when two people marry, they take on the commitment of supporting one another. And so therefore, whether it's during marriage or as a result of separation and divorce, there are support obligations that are automatically triggered by virtue of a marriage. And then the third thing that occurs upon marriage is the home that they live in is called a matrimonial home. And if there is a home that is owned on the date of separation, that home is considered a matrimonial home, and either spouse has two rights to that home that are triggered by marriage. Right number one is they're entitled to half of the equity in it. Right number two is they're entitled to occupy it. Those rights, those two rights, apply even if the marriage was short, even if one person is on title, even if one person brought the home into the marriage. So a perfect example, which a lot of people are surprised by, is if two people get married today and the husband moves into the wife's condominium. And let's pretend the wife owned the condominium outright. Maybe she worked and earned and paid off the mortgage. Maybe she inherited the house, the condo. However she got it, she owns it. She's on title. Then they get married. And then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, they split up. And that condo went from a value of $500,000 to $550,000 during the time that they were married. On its face, most on the street would think, well, if it went up by $50,000, the husband is entitled to half of the growth of $50,000, which is $25,000. But that's not what the law in Ontario says. The law in Ontario says that each spouse is entitled to half of that value. So if 550 divided by 2 is 275, then the wife owes the husband 275 just by virtue of marriage and just by virtue of them living together in that condominium. So to your question, Mary, how are rights changed because of marriage? To recap, marriage creates an economic partnership, marriage creates support obligations, and marriage creates the rights, two rights, to a matrimonial home upon separation.
Thank you for that, Steve. That's very important. My next question is a little bit different. How are rights changed because of separation?
So following the answer that I just gave a moment ago, separation is a process. But under the law of Ontario, it's considered a date. And what do I mean by separation? When a couple doesn't get along, the first time they have a spat, they generally don't split up. Sometimes spats last for a very long time. I've seen cases where spats have lasted for decades. But for the most part, separation is a process where people have differences, arguments, they're disconnected, they don't communicate well. In some cases, there's infidelity. But in any event, it usually happens over the course of time. But then there is a date when a decision is made, often by one, sometimes by both spouses, that they are now separated. That doesn't necessarily mean that one of them moves out. They could be separated living in the same home. But that date of separation, the date when someone says, we are done, I'm no longer with you, the date when the world starts seeing them as a separated couple, a date when they stop going out together, eating together, sleeping together, showcasing themselves as a couple together. That date, which most people know when it is, but some people don't agree. But for the most part, the date of separation is known by the two spouses, and that date of separation crystallizes the rights that each of them have stemming from the marriage. And those three rights that I talked about before, the rights to property division, the right to support, and the right to the home, are all connected to that date of separation. And what it means is that the valuation of assets that are to be divided are predicated on two dates, the date of marriage and the date of separation. And so there are people that separate, but then they don't do anything to resolve their financial affairs. And in some cases, those people go and see a lawyer years later, and they ask the lawyer, what are my rights? And on the subject of property division, the right of the spouse stemming from marriage goes back to the date of separation. So for example, I had a case that I just recently settled where the couple separated 15 years ago. And I was asked to provide advice to my client with respect to his rights stemming from the marriage and from the separation. We had to rebuild and investigate his assets and his debts going back 15 years in order to calculate the division of property, because the date of separation is the date that the economic partnership ends. And so to your question, Mary, how are rights changed because of separation? Separation, or specifically the date of separation, is the date when the rights get triggered and get crystallized. In fact, there are many that would argue that even the support rights are crystallized at the date of separation. And what do I mean by that? Let's pretend on the date of separation, the wife was a stay-at-home mom and the husband earned $75,000 a year. Some would say, well, the support obligation that the husband has to the wife, for the wife and for the children, is predicated on her income of zero and his income of $75,000. But what happens if 2 years later, her income is $60,000 and his is $100,000? So there are two schools of thought on that. There are those that would say, well, when they split up, his income was 75 and hers was zero. That should establish the support obligations. And then there's another school of thought that says, well, but today, 2 years later, her income is 60,000 and his is 100,000. So therefore, it should be predicated on today's values and today's incomes. And the short answer is both are right. And lawyers grapple and judges grapple with how do we deal with that. In other words, should the wife benefit from the husband's post-separation salary increase? Should the husband be relieved of his support obligation to his wife, who has since separation found employment? And those are challenging questions. And for the most part, we are able to resolve them. But back to the point about how our rights changed because of separation, the answer is that is how. The separation date is what triggers the rights.
And the next question, also related to that, is how are rights changed because of divorce?
So a moment ago, we talked about how rights are changed because of separation. And actually, the rights, or specifically the main right, which is the right of property division, has what's called a limitation period. So when a couple splits up, there is a limitation period that runs to determine if and when there should be a division of property. And the limitation period is the earliest of three dates. In other words, whichever of the following three dates happen first, that's when the right to property division upon separation expires. The first one is 6 months after death of one spouse. The second one is 2 years after divorce. And the third one is 6 years after living separate and apart. So to the question, how are rights changed because of divorce? If a person splits up today and then divorces in 6 months, the 2-year limitation period is triggered from the date of divorce, meaning a person has, from the date of divorce, 2 years in order to seek a division of property. And for those listening, this is really important because if there is a pension, if there are RRSPs, if there is a house in one person's name, those generally are very valuable assets, and in some cases worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the right to get those assets divided expires when the limitation period lapses. And divorce moves a 6-year limitation period that would normally run from the date of separation, and it shortens it down to 2 years. So the person who divorces today, who didn't divide their property, basically has 2 years from today to divide their property, otherwise they lose that right. And if they didn't divorce and there's no death, then it would be 6 years from separation. The other thing that divorce does is divorce terminates the title of spouse. When a person is married, the legal term for their husband or wife is spouse. When a person separates, they are still considered spouses. But when a person divorces, they are no longer considered spouses. They are now considered former spouses legally. And the reason that's relevant is for estate planning purposes. Because when somebody is no longer a spouse under the law, then they lose rights that are only accorded to spouses. And those rights often are found in documents such as RRSPs, pensions, wills, life insurance. And so therefore, the word spouse is very critical. And divorce ends that title.
And my next question is, what is a power of attorney and how does that interplay with a will?
So everybody knows what a will is. A will is something that anybody can do if they are an adult and if they're capable. And a will is a document that someone sets out what would happen upon their death. A will has no legal effect until death. At the time of death, the executor of a will opens the will and determines what it was that the deceased person set out in their will to occur upon their death. Oftentimes, a will say who gets their assets. A will also say how they want to be buried. A will also set out, if they have minor children, how they would like those children to be raised. The reason it's called a will is because it was their will to have these events occur after death. But like I said, a will has no effect until death. A power of attorney is a document that only works from the date of incapacity till the date of death. So a power of attorney is used by someone to say, in the event that I am unable to make a decision for myself regarding my health, regarding my property, I appoint this other person under a power of attorney. That person's called an attorney. Under the power of attorney, that person is the substitute decision maker for the person that signed in an earlier and in a healthy state a power of attorney. So the person who, for example, signs a power of attorney and then suffers from Alzheimer's, dementia, has a stroke, and is unable to make decisions regarding themselves or their health or their property, the attorney under the power of attorney becomes empowered, and they receive the powers that are set out in the power of attorney. And those powers usually are the power to decide the incapable person's health care and the power to decide how their money and property is to be used. So typically people that have powers of attorney also have wills. And in some cases, the attorney under the power of attorney is the very same person, which is the executor under the will. But it doesn't have to be that way. Somebody can appoint one person to be the power of attorney for their health, one other person to be the power of attorney for their property, and a different person to be the executor in case they die. And so the reason why a power of attorney is so important is because a power of attorney gives the power to somebody to decide the quality of care, the medical treatment that a person receives after they're no longer able to make the decisions themselves. And it also gives the power to the attorney under a power of attorney as to how to use their property and their money. So if a will, for example, says, I want my house to go to my children upon my death, but the person is incapable for years before death, the power of attorney gave the attorney the power to sell the house, to use the money to pay for the incapable person's health care, maybe funeral. So it's possible that the attorney under a power of attorney could actually usurp the intentions under a will by using and spending the money that would otherwise be in the hands of the executor to distribute upon death. Now, of course, whether you're an attorney under a power of attorney or an executor under a will, you have a fiduciary obligation, which just basically means you are a trusted person. So the person is trusted or entrusted with those decisions. And oftentimes people choose attorneys and executors who they wholeheartedly trust will do the right thing and not abuse their powers. And in the event that a trustee or an executor or an attorney under a power of attorney does abuse their powers, the other family members or beneficiaries have the right to challenge their conduct.
And my next question then is, can anyone get married in Canada? For example, could it be an immigrant, a same-sex marriage, people who are terminally ill and incapable?
Well, this is a good question, Mary, because it's now leading to the very subject of this webinar, and that is, if somebody is ill can they marry? On its face, most people would say, of course. In fact, there's many stories, very romantic stories, of people that marry, that met because of illness and marry because of the caregiving relationship that was formed through the process of addressing someone's health. And I'll get to that in a moment, but the quicker answers on the can anyone marry, well, first of all, minors can't marry. So if your 13-year-old daughter says to you, I'd like to get married tomorrow, she doesn't have the power to.
And so that's a minors, good thing.
That's a good one. So children can't marry. Let's move along. Can an immigrant marry? Of course. The fact that they may be here illegally, or the fact that they may not have received their permanent resident status, still allows them to marry under the laws of Ontario. Can a same-sex person marry? Absolutely. And for those that have been following the news in Canada, not only can people of the same sex marry in Canada, we are a torchbearer to the world on the fact that our government had authorized people of the same sex to marry in Canada, and we have been praised by communities all over the world of being a country that recognizes the equality of people of the same gender being able to marry. And in fact, right when the laws were changed, there was a flood of same-sex partners who attended Ontario to get married. But now let's get to the nitty-gritty of this conversation, which is predatory marriages. And so we'll get to what that means in a moment, but if you think about the fact that we are now in a society where people are living longer. People are living longer because of medical care, because of medicines, because of supports. It used to be that if somebody broke their hip, they likely were going to die shortly thereafter because of lack of mobility and the shutdown of their organs. But now people have hip replacement surgery. People live longer because of that. People are cured, or at least are treated, when they suffer from cancer. Cancer is not necessarily, the way it once was, an immediate death sentence. So you have other diseases and disorders that are also effectively treated by medicine. And moving along the line, you have other disorders that are cognitive, that are psychological, whether that be dementia, Alzheimer's, bipolar disorder, psychotic disorder, delusion, senility. There is a whole host of diseases and disorders that affect people all along the spectrum insofar as their age. But now let's deal with the cognitive disorders, specifically dementia and Alzheimer's. There are thousands of Ontarians who suffer from Alzheimer's and dementia. And some of them are living in their homes, and their family has arranged for caregivers to live with them or visit them. Some of them are living in nursing homes or retirement homes, assisted living facilities. And so these thousands of Ontarians that are suffering from Alzheimer's or dementia are presenting on a different place on the spectrum. Some of them have still memories of who their family members are, and some of them don't. Some of them can't even recognize their children. Some of them don't have the ability to remember where they were born or how old they are or even what their name is. There is a whole spectrum of dementia and Alzheimer's. And in many of these cases, there are support workers. And there are stories of people who fell in love with their client, with the person that they're caring for. Because despite the fact that dementia or Alzheimer's affects memory, it doesn't affect a person's ability to engage in a healthy relationship, in a loving relationship, in a romantic relationship. And in that situation, when we look at who can marry, it's a very difficult conversation because there's a question of morality, not just legality, on the question of who can marry. It would be wrong of us to deprive a person who suffers from Alzheimer's with the right and the privilege to have a relationship with somebody. But on the other end of that, when you are the adult child of somebody who suffers from Alzheimer's and you hire a caregiver to be with your mother or your father, you're not expecting that caregiver to be your mother or father-in-law. And you're certainly not expecting that caregiver to secretly be engaging in a romantic relationship with the parent that you love and care for so dearly. And so, can somebody with Alzheimer's marry? That question has not been answered by the law in Ontario, but there are cases that have gone on both sides of that question. And in some cases, the judges have said the person had the mental capacity to marry. They did not have the mental capacity to do a will. They did not have a mental capacity to sign a car lease or a cell phone contract or a mortgage, but they had the capacity to marry. And then there are other cases where judges have said, this is clearly a case where the person could not have understood the implications of marriage. And even though that person and their caregiver are now married, that marriage is void because that person could not have understood what they were doing when they got married. And so to your question, Mary, can anyone get married in Canada? On the subject of people that suffer from cognitive disorders like dementia and Alzheimer's, the answer is we don't know. It's fact specific, and each case is going to be decided on its own merits.
And to comment on that and the statistics about our population getting dementia and Alzheimer's is obviously increasing dramatically. And so these issues, I am guessing, Steve, will come to the court more often. And as a lawyer, you will see these issues grow just because this disease is taking over our population. And so it will be interesting as a layperson to watch what happens as lawyers and judges deal with this growing issue. Very interesting topic.
It is. And as a adult child of a person with Alzheimer's who visits his mother regularly at her long-term care facility, I see almost daily what is occurring in the halls of these long-term care facilities. There are people that have no caregivers. They just rely on the nursing staff at the place. There are people that have part-time caregivers who work a couple hours a day or a couple days a week. And there are people that have full-time staff there around the clock who the family has paid for in order to care for the person, to change the person, to bathe the person, to feed the person, to sing to and with the person. And what I see in the halls is absolutely beautiful, because what we see, what I see, is a lot of good quality care and a lot of love. And I hired for my mom a part-time caregiver who shows my mom a tremendous amount of love, and my mom shows her a tremendous amount of love. In fact, my mom says to her, I love you. Does that mean my mom has the capacity to marry? I don't think so. But if my mom was not a mom, but my father, and my father was saying to the caregiver, I love you, and the caregiver said back to my mom, to my father, I love you, do they have the capacity to marry? These questions cannot be answered with a rule of thumb or with some parameter. I'm not even so sure that you could answer that question with a psychiatric test, because it's a legal question. Can a person form the legal intention to marry? And that question is a very challenging question. By the way, equally as challenging as, can a person decide when they want to expire? Can a person decide that they would like to have their life terminated? These are very difficult questions that invoke ethical, moral, religious, constitutional considerations that are very difficult to answer. And any two people can very realistically have two very different views on the very same subject. And may I suggest to you, Mary, that a lot of people within the family have a difference of opinion on those questions. There could be two adult children of a person with dementia who think very differently on the very same issue with the same caregiver and the same parent who has Alzheimer's. And these are very tough questions that I think society, for the reasons I mentioned earlier about the increased number of people who are suffering from dementia, I think society is going to have to face up to these very challenging questions and recognize that there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all answer that is going to apply to everybody.
And you know, that's so true. My mom also had dementia, and the stress just watching her decline was so hard for us. But to build in the other complexity of having her in a relationship and even the thought of getting married to somebody, that must send families just over the moon with shock and disbelief. I mean, it's one thing to care for them, but you rarely would ever normally think that the caregiver would be that important to someone to get married. And so my next question is, what is a predatory marriage?
Well, we have beautifully segued into that by answering the last question. A predatory marriage, or another word for it is an exploitative marriage, is when somebody marries another person and the person that they marry is unhealthy. That person might suffer from dementia. That person might have Alzheimer's. They may have some other cognitive disorder that prevents them from understanding what happens upon marriage. And the person that's marrying that disadvantaged person, that incapable person, oftentimes is healthy physically, psychologically, and mentally healthy. And in the profile of a predatory marriage, you have the younger, healthy person and the older, unhealthy person. You have a difference of economic power. You have the healthy, younger person, usually less financially fit, and the unhealthy, older, incapable person with some wealth, or in some cases, great wealth. So you have, as a foundation, a significant difference of health, a significant difference of age, a significant difference of financial wealth. And when you look at those three differences and you understand what happens upon marriage, which is what I answered before, marriage creates an economic partnership and an automatic right to a matrimonial home. So to use a perfect example, in this day and age, adult children who have a parent who suffers from Alzheimer's oftentimes are coached and advised by the healthcare people that what would be best would be to keep the Alzheimer's person living in their own home, where they have all of their amenities, where they know their bedroom, their kitchen, their family room, where they're comfortable, and to keep them there as long as possible. But to bring in caregivers, maybe one, maybe two, maybe three, to share shifts, because it would be easier for the family, easier for the person with Alzheimer's to continue the status quo by living in their home. That sounds fair. Having moved my mother twice now to different facilities, it's extremely difficult, but not difficult on the adult children, difficult on the person with Alzheimer's, because you're changing their environment, and that is very difficult for them. So keeping them in their environment as long as you can is definitely a goal of the medical community, of the psychological community, and of society in general, so long, of course, as the family can afford it. So going back to the subject of a predatory marriage, in a situation where you have this tremendous imbalance of financial power, health, and age, if the caregiver marries the Alzheimer's patient, that house now becomes half-owned by the caregiver just by virtue of marriage. The other thing that happens, and this is very important, the last will and testament that the person with Alzheimer's created before they were diagnosed with Alzheimer's is invalidated, negated, and terminated by marriage. To be very clear, the act of marriage terminates a will. And there's exceptions to that, unless the will said that this will was created in anticipation of marriage. But for the vast majority of people that have Alzheimer's who have wills, the act of marriage terminates the will. And whether that's a predatory marriage or a completely appropriate marriage, the fact of the matter is marriage terminates a will. So when you think about those rights that I talked about earlier, the rights of economic partnership, the rights to spousal support, and of course the right to the home, you could see how a clandestine act by a caregiver to marry a Alzheimer's person could be seen as an exploitation or an act of a predator. And that is what a predatory marriage is.
So in Ontario, could you describe what the law is to prevent these predatory marriages?
Well, regrettably, Mary, currently there is no specific protection from a legal standpoint. The best protection is from a family and medical care standpoint. And what do I mean by that? Involved adult children children who are regularly visiting their incapable parents are the best protection for the incapable person who might be the victim of a predator. Clearly, choosing the caregiver, interviewing the caregiver, checking the references of a caregiver, but more importantly, regularly checking in on the Alzheimer's parent, that is the best protection. In other parts of Canada, so for example, in British Columbia and in Alberta, there are some legal protections to prevent predatory marriages. So that currently is not the case in Ontario. There is a group of lawyers who are currently working on a submission to seek a change to the laws in Ontario that would provide greater protection. But as we speak today, there is no legal protection specifically to prevent a predatory marriage. And therefore, if you think about it, a person can have the capacity to make a will, then they get Alzheimer's, then they can have the capacity to marry, although some would debate whether they could or not after they had Alzheimer's. The marriage invalidates the will, and then, now that they're incapable and they're married, they do not have the capacity to make a will. And so, where there's no will and there's a death, the estate of the deceased goes to their legal spouse. And if there are children, adult children, there's what's called a preferential treatment or preferential share of the estate that goes first to the legal spouse and then gets divided amongst the other children. And so this is a very serious issue, one that will require the government of Ontario to look at and to hopefully provide protections. But there have been cases where the children, the adult children of the deceased, are suing or have sued the caregiver who became the legal spouse of their adult parent. And they have sued them on different grounds. They have sued them to void the marriage on the basis that the parent didn't have capacity to marry. They have sued them for fraud or deceit. They have used various legal doctrines to argue in court that a person should not be allowed to profit from their wrongdoing. And many of these cases have been very, very expensive, difficult, and quite frankly, the outcome is not very clear. So to your question, Mary, what's the law to prevent predatory marriages? There isn't very much law in Ontario right now. There might be in the future. But my advice to families that have a parent with dementia or other sorts of cognitive disorders is be present, be aware, be careful.
Thank you for that, Stephen. And you know, sometimes our families don't live close. Someone might not be able to visit their mom who is in a facility with dementia. And so for them, the stress of distance can be so hard, and not watching over somebody adds great stress to the whole issue of caregiving. And I'm sure you see families that are shocked when these kinds of things happen. And I have actually heard of situations where these predators will go and read the obituaries and start to seek out these widows or people who have lost their spouse to go and purposely be that next new spouse. And so it's a sad statement on society, but we need to watch out for our elderly. And even if your mom lived across the country, I would hope that somebody close to her physically could watch out and report back to you about what is going on, because this is so terrible, and these poor souls are lured into marriage without, I don't think, knowing the consequences that you've described. So thank you so much for bringing this topic to our project, and I hope that the audience has learned so much by what you have said. So thank you so much for doing that.
You're very welcome, Mary. It was a pleasure. And if anybody who is listening to this has questions, comments, thoughts, or even ideas on what can be done, I am willing to speak and to hear those ideas. And so I invite anybody to email me and share with me their questions or their ideas. And my email address is steve@benmore.com, and that's spelled S-T-E-V-E at B as in Bob, E, N as in Nancy, M as in Mary, O-R as in Ralph, .com, steve@benmore.com.
Thank you so much for that. And now I would like to close with a few comments with one of our board directors, Chris Cata.
Mary, who are our initial project supporters?
We wish to acknowledge that this project is funded in part by the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program. Our other initial supporters include Care Connect, The Care Guide, The Healing Cycle Foundation, and Scotia Trust. Caregiving Matters is an internet-based registered Canadian charity dedicated to educating and supporting family caregivers. 90% of our work is done online and by leveraging technologies. 10% is done by producing local educational events. We leverage technologies in everything that we do, ensuring greater reach and sustainability. I trust that we have given you some of the highlights of our exciting new initiative. If you are interested in speaking with me about the project, please let me know. We look forward to your questions and your ideas.
Mary, if listeners have questions, what's the best way for them to contact us?
Well, they can contact me, Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. My email is mary@caregivingmatters.ca. Our telephone number is 905-939-2931, and our website is www.caregivingmatters.ca.